All right, let me tell you a little bit about David Icke, and it is Icke, not Icky. He's billed as the most controversial and challenging man in Britain. He speaks openly about issues that others fear discussing. He exposes the lies and deceit of thousands of years and reveals the biggest secret, how humanity has been controlled and manipulated since prehistory by extraterrestrial gods, small g, and the secret society network they created and continue to orchestrate today. In this profusely illustrated presentation, he exposes an astonishing web of interconnected manipulation to reveal that the same few people, secret societies, organizations control the daily direction of our lives. They engineer wars, terrorist outrages, political assassinations, control the world market in hard drugs, the media indoctrination machine. He reveals how religions, politics, banking, and business have been designed from the beginning to control and suppress human potential in pursuit of long-term agendas. The mental, emotional, and spiritual enslavement of the human race. He shows how spiritual and scientific knowledge has been hoarded in the hands of the few since ancient times while being systematically withdrawn from public circulation. Oh my, that's quite an introduction. Here is David Icke. David, welcome.
Thank you. Well, yeah, that should fill a nice 3 hours, shouldn't it, really?
It certainly will. David, your last name is spelled I-C-K-E, and in the last couple of weeks since I've been sort of mentioning that you're going to be around, I've heard other people say Icky, and I fell into the same rut and said Icky. Nobody would pronounce their name Icky. But when you were a child, David, based on how it's spelled here, did you have a rough time with this one?
No. They called me Icke.
They called you Icke?
Yeah. I mean, you don't pronounce the C. Actually, funny enough, I had a friend, you know, his name was Bill Shufflebottom. And I said to him once, hey, have you thought of changing your name? He said, yeah. I said, I was going to call myself Charlie Shufflebottom at one time, he said, but I never got around to it. You know?
Yeah. Well,
what's in the name and all that?
Well, children in Britain are obviously much more kind-hearted, not so mean-spirited.
Oh, no, it's the same the world over.
Right. So they never called you Icky?
Not that I recall.
All right. Anyway, I just sort of read a broad outline of the incredible road we're about to go down.
Uh-huh.
How did you come to all of this, I think, would be the proper first question.
Well, it's like everything. It's a journey. I started out life as a professional soccer player in England when I left school back in the late 60s.
A professional?
A professional soccer player, yeah. I was a goalkeeper. Yeah, they used to call me Cinderella because I kept missing the ball, you know. But
kidding. I actually came to love soccer. I went to France during Coupe de France, and I had never been exposed to soccer, and I saw the English game playing Argentina, and it was astounding. I sat in my hotel room in Paris, and I watched that, and I became a soccer fan. Boom.
Yeah, well, I was doing that, back in the 60s, but arthritis finished my career when I was 21, and became a journalist, and worked for newspapers and radio, and eventually became a frontline television link man with the BBC. And towards the end of the 80s, however, in fact earlier than that, I started looking at the world and what was going on, and didn't like what I saw. And towards the end of the 80s, more in the very early 90s, I went through what you might call, a spiritual awakening. It was more like an explosion. Not religious, by the way. If God saved us from religion. A spiritual awakening, where I started to realize that there was far more to life than the human entity and who we were and the power that we had than ever we were told, because we're given this choice, basically, between a judgmental God. And if you listen to this guy in a long frock, he'll tell you what God wants, and so listen to me and you'll be fine.
Mm.
And on the other side, what we laughingly call science, which basically says this world is all there is, and it's all we're all a cosmic accident. And it's quite a choice to make, you know. Am I subject to some judgmental God, or am I a cosmic accident? And I started to realize that there was far more evidence available that was being suppressed in the public arena. And so I started on this journey of uncovering this suppression, and it was a trickle to start with. And as the 90s have unfolded, I've been in over 20 countries in the last 18 months talking and researching. Because if you're doing this job, you've got to listen as much as you talk, or you don't pick up the evidence and the information that's available. And the suppression of what you might call spiritual information became the suppression of political information, the suppression of how a very few people control this world through a series of interconnecting pyramids in which most people in those pyramids haven't got a clue what's going on. You know, people say it's the Freemasons. Well, you know, I've got a lot of friends who are Freemasons, and they are completely in the dark about what's going on. It's not the Freemasons. It's not the Jews. It's not the anyone. It's an organization that works through all of these apparently uncontrolled areas of life and manipulates to a particular and very long-term agenda, a great point in which we're now facing as this 20th century comes to a close. And it's an organization within all organizations, not the Freemasons or whatever. They work through all these different organizations. And so it's been a journey, and getting the information now is no longer a problem. It's a tidal wave, because once you put your head above the trench with this, you attract people in with information who don't know what to do with it or are frightened to put it out themselves. The challenge I have is not gathering information, it's fitting the picture together and seeing how the pieces fit together and how that affects what's coming up now across the millennium, because this is a particular time when a lot of cards are going to be played to put the human race into a position of even greater mental and emotional imprisonment than we've been thus far.
At the beginning of all this, you suggest, right at the beginning of what I read, that humanity has been controlled and manipulated since prehistory by extraterrestrial gods and the secret society network they created and continue to orchestrate. What proof do you have of that, or what convinced you might be a better question?
Well, to see the scale of the evidence, people have to read the books that I write, which are lengthy and detailed, and this particular one's coming out, The Biggest Secret, in the new year, in February. Because what I do is I take vast amounts of information from different sources, and I look for the key common themes. I look for the cross-references. I look for the common things that keep coming up that push you in a certain direction. I don't follow a belief system. I follow information. I let the information be my guide to where I go, not preconceived ideas. And when you get the information together from vast numbers of sources, mm-hmm. You can pick up in the ancient world basically the kind of areas where Zachariah Sitchin talks about, and others too, not just him, about this Anunnaki and the hybrid race that was created, this Anunnaki stroke human hybrid race. And then you look at the Book of Enoch, which is just a version of a much older book, the Book of Noah. And it talks there about the watchers and how the watchers, which for me and many others when they read it, are clearly an advanced race of probably not of this world who were around at that time. And it talks too about how the watchers interbred with humanity. You look at other ancient texts, it actually describes the birth of these hybrid children in very common terms, common theme terms, them being very white with white hair and with shining eyes, as one said, eyes that shone like the sun. And this hybrid race, lots of people increasingly, and I'm sure, no doubt, people have talked about this, have specialized in this particular area on your program. The question is, what happened? because what you get with most of this research is it kind of stops, and that's the end of it. What I've done is, well, what happens here? What happened to these people? And what's fascinating is that you can pick up a white race, an Aryan race, in that very kind of area that these Sumerian texts and other ancient texts talk about. And I'm talking about the mountains of Kurdistan, of Iran, of the Caucasus Mountains area of what we now call Turkey. And it's interesting that the word for white people that Americans have is Caucasian. The Caucasian after mountains in the Near East. And then you can pick this this race up. You can see how it came down into the plains of Sumer, down into Babylon, which was a major, major place in the journey through history of these bloodlines that I talk about that run the world to this day. They also moved into Egypt. And then you can follow, as the centuries unfolded, the same white race across land, and they changed their names from various times. They were the Sumerians, they were the Phaeacians. And if you follow them across the lands into what we now call Western Europe, into France, into what we call Belgium, Holland, into Germany, they changed their names as the centuries unfolded, but you can follow the flow of people and you can see that actually it's the same people. So out of this Middle East area where these this interbreeding went on came the white races that peopled Europe. There's also some tremendous research I've come across and documented in this next book that shows that a group of people, a race of people called the Phoenicians, went by sea from this same Middle East, Near East area to Britain. 3000 BC, there are standing stones in Britain that confirm this as well as other things. And when you look at the British culture, which became the Western culture, it was actually the Phoenician culture. The two deities that the Phoenicians worshipped were Barak and Barati. And Barak and Barati became Baritan and Baritania. When you look at the way the ancient Phoenicians depicted their goddess Barati, it was precisely the way the British depict their goddess Britannia. Then you look at even conventional history of how the Hindu religion was created and how the advanced civilization in the Indus Valley was created. And it was created by an Aryan race coming out of the Caucasus Mountains area and taking the Sanskrit language, which we now believe was originally Indian, but actually came with this same group. They also took in the stories that became the ancient Vedas. And so you can see that this white race, which very demonstrably has taken over the world en masse, but there are key bloodlines manipulating it that people don't realize, actually came out of this area where this hybrid extraterrestrial stroke human, these bloodlines were created, and peopled Europe. Now, when you do the research, you find that the genealogical research, you find that key bloodlines became the kings and the divine right of kings, again, by bloodline, of the these countries like Iran and that area and Egypt. And then you can also see that the aristocracy and royal families of Europe, which is actually the royal family of Europe when you look at it, it's one tribe, not actually a number of families. They became the aristocracy and they became the royal families of Europe. Now, through the great so-called British Empire, which we can get into later because it's fundamental to how these bloodlines were transported around the world, mm-hmm. these bloodlines went to the Americas. They went to Australia, to Africa, to Asia, to New Zealand. They went all over the world through the British and European expansion known as the empires. And then you do the research of the people that have run America since 1776. And it's astonishing. We've had 42 presidents so far of the United States. 33 of those 42 are genetically related to England's King Alfred the Great and Charlemagne, the great monarch of France. 19 are genetically related to England's King Edward III, who has thousands of blood connections to Prince Charles. And a stunning statistic from Burke's Peerage, which is the aristocratic genealogical Bible based in Britain, which is that since the first presidential election in America in, 1789, George Washington, the winner at every election has been the candidate with the most British and European royal genes. You look at Bill Clinton.
David,
Clinton is genetically related to the House of Windsor, the present royal family. He's genetically related to every Scottish monarch,
David,
to England's King Henry III, and to Robert I of
France. David, one could imagine this genealogy having connections in the early presidents. No question about it.
Mm-hmm.
But as late as Bill Clinton...
As late as Bill Clinton. I mean, you know, I'm not plucking this out of the air. This has come from Bert Steerage, the Bible of aristocratic genealogy on the planet.
All right. Hold on, David. We're at the bottom of the hour, and we'll be right back. All right. Back now to David Icke. David, this is amazing what you're laying out for us. The implications are that there, I guess, is a secret pool of knowledge that has been passed down among those with the right lineage. Am I getting that about right?
Yeah, I mean, people need to ask themselves why the Eastern establishment of the United States interbreeds as obsessively as the royal families and the aristocratic families of Europe have always done. You take, for instance, George Bush. George Bush and Barbara Bush are the same bloodline. They go back to the Pierce bloodline, which is actually the Percy bloodline. They changed from Percy to Pierce when they crossed the Atlantic, which is an aristocratic family going way back in England. And so this obsessive interbreeding is not, as we've been led to believe, genetic snobbery. It's because they're trying to hold a genetic structure. And the stunning detail with which they keep these records of these lineages is unbelievable, really. And therefore, there is something which we need to establish, which is very, very important to these people, to do with the genetics and the blood. And it also connects into this thing the Nazis talked about. Indeed, not just the Nazis, but other people like Lord Bulwer-Lytton in his book, The Coming Race. Again, he was part of the genetic bloodlines too, an English guy, where they talked about the vril power in the blood that created, quote, Superman. And this obsession with the genetics of the body and holding that genetic structure, it's to do with what it gives them and what powers it gives them. And they, of course, this has got dissipated in some of these lines. Of course it has. But there are key lines that they have obsessively held as pure, quote, as they possibly can, from how they started back in the ancient world when they had this extraterrestrial intervention. And amazing when you follow these bloodlines, just very quickly, Art, that when you follow them, you find the people who are running the banking system, who are running the transnational corporations, who end up at the top in politics, who are big people in the media, the people who are at the top in these secret society pyramids. I'll give you just a very quick example of how obsessive it is. Contact of mine, a brilliant contact, has proved to be accurate, stunningly so, time and time again over the last 2 years. He's got a close friend, who was approached by an American government agency to courier drugs for them. And he was kind of taken aback by this, and he said, well, basically, no, but what the heck are you asking me for? And to his astonishment, the reply came, we know what your bloodline is. And this bloodline, I can't emphasize enough, is so important to these people. And if anyone out there can give me more information on exactly why this obsession is there and what powers it gives them, I'll be delighted to hear from them.
Hey, here's something I want to understand. You said genetic intervention. I've heard this from many, many people, Zachariah Sitchin and forward.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this genetic intervention early on, was this what took the early caveman, the early, at some stage, to the modern intelligent human being that we now know? Is that the change for all of humanity, and were there special changes in certain human beings then
That's a very interesting question, and I don't think we can be definite on that going that far back. When you look at the Sumerian text, they do remarkably describe what we would call test tube betas, test creation of humans in through test tubes and what have you, which, given that they were found in the middle of the last century and were buried something like 2000 BC, was absolutely astonishing, as many other things in the text are, particularly about astronomy and the planets and the solar system, which has only been confirmed in relatively very recent times. But in terms of the time scale and the scale of the intervention in terms of its effect on the human race in general, I'm still kind of open-minded about that. What is...
But, I mean, the implications, what you're saying, are that there was more than one intervention, or that...
That's the point.
Yeah.
That's the point. For me, there's been more than one intervention at different times. I think that if you go back and you look at the estimates that people like Sitchin put on it, that this Anunnaki arrived maybe around 450,000 years ago, I wouldn't dismiss or argue with that. I think that's not a bad time scale when this thing possibly started. But when another thing that I've looked at in my books, and particularly in great detail in this next one, is that the evidence for not just one major cataclysm on this Earth, but a number in the window of 13,000 years ago and much more recently, the evidence is phenomenal, not just in the geological and biological record, but also in the endless records and accounts and oral traditions all over the world in all the different cultures. And I think that one of the key areas, the key times for the intervention that created these particular, what I will call, royal bloodlines,
mm-hmm.
because interestingly, the Sumerian texts talk about the fact that the Anunnaki created what they called Anuship, kingship. In other words, almost a middleman group of bloodlines that were the middle controllers between the extraterrestrials and the mass of the human race.
All right, then may we think of ourselves as an ant colony? In other words, there are worker ants. There are various levels of ants to the queen. And isn't that kind of what you're saying was done to the human race? They created a genetic strain of workers, which Sitchin believes.
Mm-hmm.
He believes, I think, to mine gold.
Yeah.
I
have many questions about that area, I must say. But I take your point. It's not a bad summary. What I feel is, however, is this, and this is the positive side that we've really got to get our heads around across this millennium. The human race is not ordinary, and it's not powerless, but if you are a relative handful of people and you want to control a mass of the people,
yes,
you cannot do it physically. This manipulation is not physical. There's not enough people. If you try to control a herd of sheep physically, you need four or five guys, maybe more, chasing each sheep.
You bet.
But it's not done like that with a herd or a flock of sheep. Most of them follow the one in front without question. And the others, the stragglers that don't immediately conform to that bar-bar mentality, they are given the dose of the four-letter word that controls this world, fear, through the sheepdog, and then most of them, if not all of them, come into line. So what we're looking at is a mental and emotional manipulation that has bombarded, and the creation of religions, the major religions and others, has been fundamental in this. And again, look where all the major religions came out of. This same area of the world, Christianity, Judaism, Hinduism, out of the Caucasus Mountains, talked about earlier, Islam, all these major religions came from this same area of the world that this initial operation appears to have taken place in. And what I feel is that the key intervention was after the last cataclysm. It's interesting that when you look at the evidence of where agriculture started in the known world, it was at heights above 10,000 feet, which absolutely fits with the fact that there was some kind of massive flood or flow of water. In those mountains that I'm talking about, that area of the Middle and particularly the Near East, that mountainous area, the Caucasus, what we call Turkey, Iran, all that area,
yes,
That's, for me, the evidence that I put in some considerable detail in this next book, where this key intervention took place that created these particular bloodlines. When the waters then started to recede down from these mountains into the valleys of, and the plains of Sumer, Babylon, Egypt, came these people. Now, there were two levels of knowledge. There was the advanced knowledge, which the extraterrestrials and their hybrids had access to, and there was the rest of the people. And what happened, it seems, when you talk to many researchers into this area, is that the mystery schools were set up, some of them very positive, to pass on some advanced information to people they considered were worthy and would use it positively. But as this years passed, this mystery school network was infiltrated, and indeed a negative mirror of it was created. And therefore, instead of passing on this advanced information, which was clearly available, I mean, look at the pyramids. Look at some of the great structures of the ancient world. The one at Baalbek in the Lebanon, which involved moving three chunks of stone, each of which were 800 tons, at least a third of a mile, and putting them high up in a wall. I mean, you know, our primitive people are going to do that. So we've only got to look at what the ancient world has left us around the planet to see that there was a very advanced knowledge there. You look at the way that the ancient structures and the stone circles are phenomenally connected to star systems, to natural cycles, to the precession of the equinoxes. There was advanced knowledge in the ancient world. What happened is that this was sucked in as the years passed into this mystery school and later secret society network, and was passed on at the highest level only to those which were given or were chosen to have it.
David, was this a physical science or a mental science?
I think it was absolutely both. You know, some of the information that's now coming to light in shows like yours and others, where we're seeing the true nature of what is possible beyond what we call science, which is actually not science at all, most of it. It's not about open-minded research. It's about defending a belief system and a dogma. And this stuff that's now emerging actually is re-emerging into the public domain at this tremendous time of transformation that's happening now and is going to advance very much across the millennium and into the first 10 years or so of the next century.
Are you aware of an organization called the PsyCop?
Yeah.
Yeah. The Skeptical Inquirer.
Well, I've actually talked about it, and it's quite interesting in this next book, The Biggest Secret.
Oh, have you really?
Yes, it is amazing how they cross-reference a number of their personnel with mind control operations. If anyone wants to read about that, then it will be available, and the names will be named in the new year.
No kidding.
It's very interesting how you've got an organization which is suppressing and trying to get people not to look at information and dismiss it, are also involved in some other areas say the least, are extremely questionable.
Well,
I reveal some of the background to this organization in my next book, and people ought to know that before they go the way of dismissing information just because it's being ridiculed by these people.
This coming Friday, they're giving me in Los Angeles this special honor they call the Snuff Candle Award.
Uh-huh.
They say they're giving it to Art Bell, the less than prestigious award, the Snuff Candle Award, for encouraging credulity, presenting pseudoscience as genuine, and contributing to the public's lack of understanding of the methods of scientific inquiry.
Right. Well, I tell you what, I wouldn't buy a used car or a new one off any of them. And people will see why when they read the next book. I think if anyone who gets an honor from this group of that kind should actually take it as an honor, because there are some people, when they're on your side, you know you're on the wrong one. And PsyCops is certainly one of them.
Well, I'm accepting it in that spirit.
Yeah, and I don't blame you. So the pressure, and this is a good example. If you are going to control vast numbers of people, you have to delink them from knowledge that you're doing it, and you have to delink them from an understanding of their true power. You have to persuade them that they are ordinary, that they are powerless, that they are pawns in a game, because then they won't realize that if they just realized who they are, there would be no game. One of the techniques, there are many techniques that you can pick up if you follow these bloodlines across the century, right into the modern world, of how people are mass manipulated by techniques that just go on being repeated and repeated and repeated. And we can see them happening daily now as we enter this crucial period across the millennium when lots of cards are going to be played.
Give me some examples of control, for example, through the modern media.
Well, let me outline the most powerful, the most used, and the most effective. And I think this actually will apply very much to some of the UFO stuff that's going on.
Sure.
It's a technique that I call in my books problem, reaction, solution. You start with something you want to introduce. Say you want to give more power to the police. You want to have more power to stop and search, more power to tap phones, or you want politicians to have more power to bring in a certain policy.
Sure.
You know that if you introduce that policy honestly and say, right, we're going to do this, there would be a mass reaction because people would say, excuse me, over here. That's a fascist state you're trying to introduce here. We're not having this.
Yeah, what about our Bill of Rights?
So what you do is you create a problem. It could be a terrorist bomb. It could, like Oklahoma, it could be a run on the currency, a government collapse, Y2K, whatever. And you create a problem. People then react to that problem, and you encourage them through the media to say, this can't go on. Something must be done. What are they going to do about it?
Mm.
And at that point, they, who have covertly created the problem but got someone else to be blamed for it, glean that reaction, do something, then openly offer the solutions to the problems they have themselves created. Problem, reaction, solution. So if you want more power to the police, more stop and search, more draconian laws, then what, and you want people not just not to oppose it but to demand you do it, then you let society break down so there is more crime.
Sure, you don't even have to actually suggest it. You just create the situation and the public comes to you demanding that you change it.
Exactly. And if we just apply this to the UFO situation. Now, as we've discussed already, I have absolutely no problem with an extraterrestrial aspect to all this. Certainly not. But what I would say is the, quote, aliens aren't coming. They've been here for thousands of years working through these bloodlines and through other means. And when you look at the way that the human consciousness is being prepared, you first of all look through Hollywood. Hollywood's one of the great homes of mind conditioning. Wherever I go in the world, the Hollywood films are playing, the Hollywood videos are available.
Oh, yeah.
All over the world. And then you look at things, the patterns that are emerging. You look at Independence Day, made by 20th Century Fox, owned by Rupert Murdoch, who is owned by this brotherhood. You look at Alien Resurrection, made by 20th Century Fox, owned by Rupert Murdoch, who is owned by this brotherhood. You look at X-Files, which is made by Fox Television, which is owned by Rupert Murdoch, who is owned by this brotherhood. And if you're looking at problem, reaction, solution in regard to this extraterrestrial situation, then look back at the report from Iron Mountain, which was produced between 63 and 66, a report with 15 experts in various fields asked to produce ways of centralizing power and controlling the population without further recourse to global wars.
All right, David, hold it there. We're at the top of the hour. When we get back, I'm going to ask you about me because I've got the largest program on radio dealing with this kind of thing. And I wonder if I'm part of it. There's been plenty of accusations about that, and at times I've wondered, could I be a pawn? I don't think that I've ever told my audience this, but my lineage, my family lineage, can actually be traced back to my family came over on the Mayflower. It was one of the original families. Now, having said that, I'm going to read David a
facts, and then we're going to see where we are here. The facts comes from British Columbia. We're heard throughout the Americas, and this is BC. Comes from Corey. Art, I need you to ask David a question. I met David in Aruba at a summer conference in June. Were you in Aruba in June, David?
Mm-hmm.
He goes on, David was signing his books at his table with many around him. I had a chance to ask him if he'd ever heard of Art Bell and why he'd never been on your program. He told me the only reason he'd never been invited on your program was because you, Art Bell, are a 33rd degree Mason and would not want to be exposed on national radio. My question for David is whether he still believes you are part of the higher elite Masons. Maybe you have this bloodline. David?
Well, I have absolutely no evidence that you're a 33rd degree Freemason, so I wouldn't suggest that you're a 33rd degree Freemason. If you're asking me about your show, I think it's...
Did you give that answer to this man? Do you recall that?
Well, I have no evidence that you're a 33rd degree Freemason, so why would I say that? I take it you're not a Freemason.
Well, I'm frequently asked if I am, and I get so sick of the question. I'm asked if I'm CIA, NSA, and all the rest of it.
Uh-huh.
I just say, sure. And that seems to stop them cold, and they don't know what to do, and they don't know what to say, and it stops them, and that's the easiest way to do it. Denial seems to go nowhere. It just reinforces their preconception of what I was. So I've given up answering no. I just say, sure.
Sure. Right. Well, in terms of programs like this or any other, it's very important that anyone listening to these shows, including listening to what I say, filter the information and ask themselves whether it feels right to them. Ask themselves a question that I filter information with all the time, which is, who benefits? Who benefits me from believing this? If I believe this, is it positive? Or if I believe this, does it... is it a problem, reaction, solution, situation, or whatever?
But how do you delineate between me and the X-Files or Independence Day or anything else? I mean, here I am, now owned by one of the largest broadcasting corporations in America, J-Corp, which is now owned by a larger corporation, maybe soon the largest in the world, Clear Channel, and Premiere and all the rest of it, and I'm a part of this giant corporate conglomerate. But I'm sitting here in my little room doing the program like I always did, no change. I've been doing it for 14 years now, David.
Right. Well, let's look at the way this thing works. If large numbers of people realized this was going on, it couldn't work. So what it's structured as is a series of pyramids. If you think of pyramids as like Russian dolls, one inside another, a bank is a pyramid. Most people working for a bank, you meet them across the counter every day.
Mm-hmm.
They're just going in, they're earning a living, and then they're going home. And they're just thinking about their families. They've not got a clue what they're part of. But at the top of that pyramid in that bank, you've got a tiny, tiny few people who know what the real agenda of that bank is. They know how all the different contributions lower down the pyramid fit together to create a direction, to create an agenda, etc.
So then,
the individual parts do not.
Then, David, could I be an unwitting dupe?
Well, we all could be unwitting dupes. This is the question we keep having to ask ourselves. If you look at the media, I was a journalist for a very long time. People say the media is manipulating. It is, but the vast, vast overwhelming majority of journalists are not knowingly manipulating anyone. They're part of a structure in which they themselves are being manipulated. You only need a very few people in this structure who know what's really going on to manipulate the whole pyramid.
Well, I have no illusions about what I am, David. I am a talk show host. I am not a journalist. Big difference.
No, I don't think there is a difference. Any situation where you have access to broadcast to the public, you are a channel of communication of information. And therefore, all of us, whether we're journalists or whether we call ourselves talk show hosts or researchers or whatever, have a duty to do whatever we can to ensure the information that hits the public is not disinformation, is actually as true as we can establish it, or at least give people the opportunity to make their own mind up. If you look at the journalistic profession, and you look at most reports in the news, where are they getting their information from? They're saying things like, White House sources say this, FBI sources say this. Most of the journalistic profession is merely a voice piece and a copy typist for the official version of events.
Quite right.
And the way the journalism is structured, someone has to be an expert on a different subject every day, and tomorrow it's a different subject. Now, people in that situation, which is what most journalists are in, are actually therefore at the mercy of what people tell them is true, and this is overwhelmingly official sources. So I had asked people, watch a CNN news bulletin, watch any news bulletin, and listen to the words and listen to the sources, and basically news bulletins are official voice pieces for the official version of events. Now, what also happens, and this is all part of the manipulation that goes back a long time, all you have to do to control the direction of the world, control the direction of people's thinking, and set the point of reference from which the media reports the world is to set the norms in society,
mm-hmm.
to set what people are conditioned to believe is right or wrong, possible or impossible, sane or insane, etc. Most people will live their lives within that those norms, that hassle-free zone, as I call it, that comfort zone. And most of the rest who realize that the norms are flawed will still live their life within them because they fear the consequences of being different in a world of uniformity. Thus it becomes a hassle to be different in this world.
Well, I will give you this. I have had great contact with the mass media right at the top, and I can tell you this. When the Associated Press runs a wire story, it's like the Holy Grail. And then the rest of the media will grab the story, and they have a certain angle with which they want to tell this story. And God help anybody who gets in the way of that angle with a fact that disputes it. It doesn't happen. It comes out the way they want it to come out. I know that to be true.
That's precisely the way it works. I mean, you sit in a newsroom, and I've sat in many, and people get journalists, they read the morning papers. They've got CNN permanently on. They've got the wires, which you talk about, giving the basically the official version of events.
Yes.
And you look at what happened to that guy on the San Jose Mercury when he and that paper had the guts to come out with the expose of how government agencies put crack cocaine onto the streets of Los Angeles.
They were stepped on.
They were hit by a tidal wave. And where did a lot of that tidal wave come from? It came from the Los Angeles Times, and it came from the Washington Post, and it came from the official, controlled, in terms of those major newspapers, media sources. And so, again, let's look at the situation in summary here. You've got the education system, which is battering children from a very early age with an official version of life. You've got the media that's pounding out the official version of life. And someone said to me once, to summed it up, they said, you know, when you're born to loving parents and they tell you that 2 and 2 equals 5, and then you go to your first school and nice teachers tell you 2 and 2 equals 5, and then you go to university and professors with lots of letters after their name tell you 2 and 2 equals 5, all your peers are telling you the same because they've been through the same system. You pick up a newspaper or turn on the television and you're being told 2 and 2 equals 5. Is it any wonder that most people go through their lives, entire lives, symbolically believing 2 and 2 equals 5? In other words, the official version of life is the only version there is.
Mm-hmm.
And delinking people from the spiritual information of the true power that we have to control our own destiny has been fundamental to this. Believing that we have to look to someone else to do it for us, that we're powerless, that we're just a cosmic accident, or we're subject to some judgmental God. In other words, we are just little people and we have no power. Once you get people in that mentality, they are a manipulator's party trick. And most people are in that mentality, and it's not by accident, it's by design. And when you, again, look at the cross-referencing of people in education opinion formers, in banking, in all these different apparently unconnected areas, they keep fitting into the same people and the same network of organizations which coordinate through these apparently unconnected areas of our lives the same basic policy. And this is why throughout the last particularly 200 years, but this century overwhelmingly, just look at any area of our lives, politics, banking, business, media, the power in all those areas has incessantly gone into fewer and fewer and fewer and fewer hands, and this fits with the agenda, which is to create a world government, which nation states would be nothing more than administrative areas to, a world central bank, a world currency, which would be electronic and not cash, for which there are fundamental implications for freedom.
No, we're on
a world army and a microchip population.
Yeah, we're on the way to that now. With regard to the economy, we're about three-quarters of the way there right now.
We are, absolutely. And as we enter or head towards this this key point in this agenda's journey through history, this millennium period, we are going to see, and we are seeing, lots of cards being played to create chaos. Chaos offers the ability or the opportunity to present order out of that chaos. What you do when you create chaos is you get people to say, do something, we're back to problem, reaction, solution, and you offer your solution to the chaos. And the solution to the chaos that is being planned in the months ahead and across the millennium is for a world government, a world army, which is designed to be NATO. And my earlier books predicted that NATO would expand into the former Soviet Union, that the European Union, which is now going to a single bank, central bank, and a single currency throughout the whole of Europe, would encompass the former Soviet Union countries. These are happening now. And the more wars, the more computer chaos, the more the aliens are coming, save us from it, the more that can be pounded into the public domain, the more the consciousness screams, do something, save us, and then the opportunity is there to offer the solution. And that's the agenda unfolding. And what I was saying earlier about the report from Iron Mountain fits magnificently with what's happening now. Two of the things that report suggested in the 1960s was A, to centralize power and control the population without wars, a global threat to the environment. And that card has demonstrably been played because 2 years after the report from Iron Mountain reported, 66, came the Club of Rome, 1968.
Mm-hmm.
Henry Kissinger, Rockefeller, Giovanni Agnelli, a major, major player in Italy, operation. And when you look at all the major global environmental reports through the 70s and the 80s saying there is a global environmental problem, something must be done, they were all fronted and funded by the very people who are dismantling this world's ecology. The first head of the UN Environment Agency was Maurice Strong, a Canadian oil millionaire, who's now an advisor to Kofi Annan, the UN Secretary General. Global 2000 report to the president at the end of the Carter administration. Again, the personnel there, like Cyrus Vance, were connected to all this network of organizations. The first head of the main head of the 1992 Earth Summit in Brazil, Maurice Strong, again, very much connected into the Rockefeller network. So the environment card has created tremendous opportunities for transnational global laws, and now, and many people in America are beginning to see this now, for great chunks of America and other parts of the world to be handed over to the United Nations to save the environment. Another thing that I expose massively in my next book is the way the Worldwide Fund for Nature has been used to create tremendous manipulation and conflict in Africa. And that, of course, is headed by Prince Philip, of which there is a great deal to know. So the environment suggestion in the report from Iron Mountain in the 60s has demonstrably been played in the 70s and the 80s. And also in that report, it suggested as a way of controlling the population and centralizing power, a threat from an extraterrestrial force. I would suggest that a number of other people are beginning to come to the same conclusion.
Are you aware that
that is now being played?
That Ronald Reagan, any number of times during his administration, sort of gave us a what if the world had band together to fight some extraterrestrial force or somebody from space. I'm sure you're well aware of what he said.
Yes, I am. And, of course, Ronald Reagan didn't move his lips without the autocue was running, symbolically or otherwise. So he said it because he was meant to say it. And I've had an interesting quote here, Art, actually, which was apparently written down by a Swiss delegate at a Bilderberg meeting in France in 1994, Bilderberg being one of the network of coordinating organizations.
Oh, yes.
And the quote is alleged to come from Henry Kissinger. Now, whether this is 100% accurate or not, it magnificently sums up the situation. What Kissinger is alleged to have said is this: today, America would be outraged if UN troops entered Los Angeles to restore order. Tomorrow, they will be grateful. This is especially true if they were told that there was an outside threat from beyond, whether real or promulgated, that threatened our very existence. It is then that all peoples of the world will plead with world leaders to deliver them from this evil. The one thing every man fears is the unknown. When presented with this scenario, individual rights will be willingly relinquished for the guarantee of their well-being granted to them by their world government. And what we're seeing now with Iraq, with Kosovo and Bosnia that went before, and these other situations where NATO, etc., is being drawn in to set the precedent of being a world army and a world police force, is problems created so the solution can be offered. And the solution is more and more power and more precedent set for NATO to become the world army it's designed to be.
Well, as a matter of fact, we're on the eve, apparently, of stomping back into Iraq with cruise missiles, at the very least, it would seem.
Well, one of the things that I document in great detail in my last book, And the Truth Shall Set You Free, is how the, and other people have done this too with excellent research, is how the two world wars, never mind the one in Iraq, the two world wars were funded and fronted by the same people who were connected to the same network. The Russian Revolution was funded from Wall Street and London. The Hitler was funded via the German subsidiaries of American and British multinational corporations and via the Bank of England, whose head at the time was a guy called Montague Norman.
All right, David,
who was a very close friend of the of Hitler's banker.
All right, hold it right there, David. David Pike is my guest. Get a pencil and paper. When we come back, we'll tell you how to get his book. Go get that pencil and paper right now. David, you've got a number of books out. If somebody was going to... if you were going to recommend that somebody buy one of your books right now, which one would you be recommending?
It would be And the Truth Shall Set You Free.
And the Truth Shall Set You Free.
Yeah, it's 500 pages of constantly sourced and highly detailed information, which takes the theory out of conspiracy theory and shows that this is happening. And it's not just someone's kind of imagination. The cross-referencing of names and information and subject areas is stunning. I think the evidence is there. What they say, the truth is out there. It certainly is if you want to look for it.
Mm-hmm. All right. And I understand right now, as in this moment, they can call the number and there's actual people there?
That's right, yeah. Some very dedicated people who are trying to you know, make sure this information gets out. 1-800-321-9054.
All right, that's 1-800-321-9054, and they can actually call right now. Now, normally, on any other day, this special deal tonight, I guess, any other day, it's between 8:30 in the morning and 5:30 in the afternoon. Is that correct?
Yeah.
All right, but folks, if the lines are busy, please keep trying no matter what you do. Write the number down. Get this book, 1-800-321-9054, and the truth shall set you free. David, who's winning right now? In other words, if this elite genealogy that is in control and trying to grab control and creating incidents. God knows we're having plenty of them. Buildings blow up in Oklahoma. Marines are blown up in Lebanon and in Arab countries and on and on and on. And now it's coming home. You know, if you really looked at it and you looked at, well, are we becoming a freer people or are we becoming a more enslaved people? I'm not very optimistic about the way it's going right now.
Well, the Chinese have a word, and the same word means crisis and opportunity, and we are at a big point of crisis and opportunity. Every crisis is an opportunity. Just to give you a quick symbolic story of the situation as I see it, I had a comedian friend who died back in England in 1995, and at his memorial service, a story was told about something that happened to him, which is a funny story, but it's stunning in its symbolism of the time we're in and where the true power lies. He was in an all-male show in the 1960s going around the music halls, and he used to do kind of female impersonation and stuff. And the last scene was all the men in the show came on the scene. It was a great show, you know, really classy, dressed as sailors, singing Rule Britannia. And they formed themselves into a pyramid on the stage, leaving a bit at the top for this guy to come on. Larry Grossman, his name was. And he came on at the end while this music was building up and the singing was going on, dressed as Britannia, you know, with the shield and the helmet and all that stuff.
Oh, sure.
And he was manhandled to the top of the pyramid for the big finish. And in his own words, in this thing that was this piece was read at his memorial service, he said, one night things seemed to be going rather well. And he's at the top of this pyramid for the big finish. And he said, but one night he said, one of the sailors in the bottom left-hand corner of the pyramid, he said, got rather a cough. And he said, eventually this little sailor boy is coughing his guts up and he can't hold his position anymore and he fell out of the pyramid. And, of course, what happened was the whole pyramid collapsed and Larry Grayson, the symbolic of this elite at the top, ended up in the second row. And what had happened there is an ordinary man and sailor in the street had got a cough, stepped out of the pyramid, and the whole thing had collapsed. What we've been manipulated to believe is that the power in a pyramidal structure is at the top. That's where the power isn't, unless we give it away. The power is in the base of the pyramid, which is holding the top there. But what happens is that we are persuaded to give our power away all the time to this authority at the top of the pyramid, and the power that is used to control the human race every day is merely the power the human race gives away every day.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the key aspects, and again, if you follow the story and the techniques from the ancient world to today, if they work, keep using them, and that's certainly what's happened, a key element has been to divide and rule the base of the pyramid, if you like. So we've had religions created, and if you follow the process, first of all, a religion is created. That creates conflict with another religion you've created. Then these individual religions, they're then broken up at one point or other into warring factions. So you've got the religions fighting among themselves and fighting with other religions. Then you bring in politics, and you do the same. You bring in business and you do banking and all this stuff. You keep bringing in all these means for conflict. And symbolically, what's happening, more than symbolically, if you look at the pyramid, is the base of the pyramid, instead of looking up and saying, who's pulling the strings of all of us, we're fighting among ourselves. I see it. You must see it, too, in the subject areas that are discussed on this show, in the UFO research area, in the conspiracy research area.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, honestly, it's like we say it in England, it's like handbags at 10 paces. I mean, if we don't stop trying to be superior over each other, trying to gossip about each other and undermine each other and all the rest of it, we've got to start uniting as a people and in areas of this research, we've got to start uniting on what we agree on. And respecting differences instead of allowing ourselves to be disunited, therefore divided and ruled, on what we don't agree on. Because it doesn't matter if you're into Judaism or you're a Christian or you're a New Ager or you're a UFO buff or whatever, we're all going to get the whirlwind unless we start working together and helping each other and supporting each other and uniting behind the thing that we all depend on, and that's not just continuing freedom, it's actually having it for the first time in a very long time. So if we allow ourselves to be divided and ruled, the fighting among ourselves, then the few are going to go on string pulling both sides. Because this is the thing I think we need to appreciate, is that if you're going to control a game, say it's a football match, if you control one side, then you're going to influence the game massively, but you're not going to control the outcome because you have an unknown quantity, which is the other team. So what this brotherhood does, as I said right at the start of our chat, it is one organization that works through many organizations. It works through both sides. So it will be at work in the UFO community, creating conflict, divide and rule, putting disinformation in there. It's the same in all areas. In this conspiracy research, it puts people in there to divide and rule and mislead. And so we've got to start getting a streetwise and starting to filter information and look at it without taking it on face value, including what I say. And we've got to start working together as a unit instead of allowing this divide and rule to go on. Because just look at the world.
Without David, without intervention, what kind of timeline do you see?
If you look at the Gregorian calendar and the way it's been structured, it's been structured to focus consciousness on the end of a cycle across what we call the millennium. Now, there's a number of things that are going to unfold here. I've already talked about the fact that many chaos cards will be played to create fear, to create division, and therefore have a global demand for something must be done, and then the agenda comes in. But also, whenever you get to a end of a cycle or a definite point or what appears to be a point in time, especially the end of a millennium, you get the consciousness start to think about, well, let's draw a line here. Let's look at all the conflict we've had in this century. Look at all the conflict we've had up to this point in this millennium. Let's start again. Let's have a new world. Let's have a blank sheet of paper. And if you can create chaos in the run-up to that and across that point, that even more encourages this mentality of, come on, we've got to start again. We need a new world. If you can then control the nature of that new world and you persuade people that centralization of power is people coming together, then you can put in global centralized institutions and you can mask them as the world coming together as one. I've talked to people, for instance, Art, in this area that's called the New Age, and they equate oneness, the world coming together as one people, with world government, world central bank, world army. Not everybody, but a significant numbers. And we need to see the difference between people coming together, having power over their own lives in their own communities, cooperating with each other across national borders, looking after each other, caring for each other, and what is actually the opposite of that, centralized institutions that are designed to put power into tiny, tiny number of hands at a global level. And I'll give you an example of where it's going, and this is already happening. When the European Central Bank for the European Union comes into force, as it is now, the currency of Europe, which will be one currency, the interest rates and what happens about that currency across the whole of Europe will be controlled by six unelected bankers with an 8-year guaranteed period of tenure. And not even the elected part of the European Union will be able to influence or override the economic decisions of those bankers. That's fascism. And if you look at the fascist symbol from which we get the word fascist, it's actually an ancient Roman symbol, which is a series of rods tied together very tightly with an axe head at the top. That's where we get the word fascism from, that Roman symbol. I just described the European Union, which is countries tied together tightly under a centralized bureaucratic dictatorship. And, of course, NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, is designed to create, in stepping stones, the America's version of the European Union.
Mm-hmm.
Because, of course, the European Union, what we joined in Europe, was not a centralized bureaucratic dictatorship, which we now have.
But we
actually joined a free trade area. That's what it was supposed to be.
Right, but David, don't we need it? If we want to compete with the Asian bloc and the European bloc, we have to do that, don't we?
Well, this is an interesting point. Again, we get the word compete and we get the word blocks. Because this goes back so far, and it has to. I mean, you cannot create the structures of manipulation that we have today in a few minutes, a few years, a few decades.
David, it's also a natural evolution. In other words, first we had little villages. They traded with other villages. Then cities trading with cities. Areas trading with areas. States trading with states. Nations trading with nations. And now blocks of nations trading with blocks of nations. And then obviously next. A one world economy.
Yeah, the question is this: when you follow the story and you see how the agenda has actually been unfolding over a very long period of time, is that a natural or is that created? When you look at the way that the whole thing's unfolded, like I said, you look at this century, but you go further back, and what you've just described actually is the process over this period of time that I'm talking about, thousands of years, and it's got quicker and quicker the more that these bloodlines have expanded their power, particularly after the expansion of the European and particularly British empires across the world, which took these bloodlines right across the planet. This thing's advanced and got quicker. But what you've just described is the process of power going into fewer and fewer and fewer hands.
Absolutely.
Now, where's it going to end? If this continues, it's going to end with the very agenda that is demonstrably being introduced now, which is complete centralization of global power. I mean, how ludicrous that we have in Europe, and this is just the stepping stone before the global level, but European laws made by bureaucrats in Brussels override nationally, apparently democratically decided laws in the individual countries. And that's just the blueprint which is being prepared for the global level, where what is dictated to at a world government level will override decisions made in your community, decisions made in your country. We're going to have a global fascist state. But of course, if that was offered openly, there'd be a reaction against it. So it's being done stepping stone style, one step following another, leading in this direction, while each step is projected in the public arena as completely unconnected to the other.
How do you know it's inevitably going to be fascist? I certainly agree that we're headed toward a single control ultimately, but how can you be sure of the nature of that control?
Well, all you've got to do is look, and the research is possible, at the people who are pressing for this to happen. If anyone's not got curly hair or hair that stands on end, then they will do when they read The Biggest Secret, because in February, because I exposed what these major players are involved in. People like Kissinger, whose power didn't end when he ceased to be Secretary of State. He operates through an organization called Kissinger Associates. And, that would make anyone's hair curl when you see what that's involved in. And you look at the major players and the names that keep coming up, and you look at what they're involved in, and it's just utterly staggering what they're involved in. The royal family. In Britain, when the story comes out, as it's going to in the book, what they're involved in, it is utterly, utterly grotesque and staggering. So you look at the personalities, the attitudes of the people who are pressing for this centralization and are manipulating it, and my goodness me, you can see where they're really coming from. And, we've got to, I think, see the difference, as I said earlier, between centralization of power and cooperation. I have no problem with global organizations that coordinate between nation states and people in their communities, that create networks of cooperation so we can help each other and all that stuff. No problem with trading and all that stuff if it's done on a fair basis. But the further that decision-making goes from the people affected by the decisions, the worse the decisions become. And now we're in a situation, we're one step away, indeed we're closing in on it fast, where decisions that fundamentally affect 5 billion or more people will be taken by a literal handful. And that is fascism. But of course, fascism and communism are the same thing. It's still centralization of power and dictatorship. It's just a different name on the door and a different dress on the door.
You cannot imagine a benign dictatorship.
Well, I think it's a contradiction in terms. if we're going to be free, we need to be free to have control over our own lives and not be dictated to by anyone. And for me, three things would change this world and change our lives. One, as individuals, we step out of the biggest prison that we live in and the prison that allows this manipulation to go on and always has, the fear of what other people think of us. Once you're in fear of what other people think, you are no longer living your life, you're living theirs. And if you can set the agenda of what is, like I said earlier, this hassle-free zone of what's right and wrong, what's good and bad, what's moral or immoral, what's sane or insane, then you set the agenda of how people judge each other.
All right, David, I think I've got it. Hold it right there for a moment. As we close this hour, we're going to take calls next hour. Yes, we're going to take calls. And I think David has made a very cogent presentation. If you would like his book, And the Truth Shall Set You Free, call right now 1-800-321-9054. That's 1-800-321-9054. If you want a copy of this entire program, beginning to end, 5 hours, you can get it by calling 1-800-917-4278. Well, I understand you might want a copy of this one. 1-800-917-4278 to get a copy of this program. That will do it for this hour. In some markets, when we get back, we'll take calls. Don't move. In a moment, with David, we're going to go to the phones. It'll be interesting to see what you have to say about all of this. And the truth shall set you free. Surely it would. The only question is, what is the truth? You've got to answer that before you can be free. All right. Once again, back to David Icke. David, before we go to phones, is there anything that, given the short time we've had, you have not been able to get on the air and want to get on the air before we do this?
Well, normally are the questions take us in all these different other areas that because. It's an amazing fact that once you see the structure and the agenda, virtually everything fits into it, because what we're looking at is not actually a series of conspiracies and manipulations, but different aspects of the same one manipulation. And I would make this point too. What I'm actually talking about, funnily enough, is not a conspiracy at its heart. It's an agenda. The conspiracy comes in three ways. One, removing those people and organizations that are a threat to that agenda becoming reality. Putting people into positions of political and economic power that will make that agenda become reality. And manipulating the mass of the people through problem, reaction, solution to get them to demand that the agenda becomes reality even though they don't realize it exists. In other words, do something, centralization of power is the answer. So these apparently unconnected conspiracies are actually connected by one thing. And that is either a threat to the agenda being removed, someone will bring the agenda in being put into power, or problem, reaction, solution to bring the agenda in and have it demanded by the public. So these are one manipulation with many faces, not a series of unconnected ones.
All right. I would like to, if I can, then go to the phones and let people ask you some questions, see how you deal with it. All right, fine.
Yeah.
Here we go. First time caller line, you're on the air with David Icke. Where are you, please?
Hello, my name's Alan. I'm in the Seattle area, and I'm listening to you on the Como 1000.
Of course.
And I have a question for David.
Hi, Alan.
Hi. I'd like to know if you know anything about Dr. Spock, you know, from the 50s. He was a psychiatrist.
The children guy.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I know nothing kind of direct on him, but in the general point, one of the things that I expose massively in the next book in February, The Biggest Secret, and other people have also done a lot of research into this area, is actually the Tavistock network in London. For historical reasons, London is a major, major center of this web. Not the government, which is just another facade, a string pulled from behind, but actually the center of this web, epicentered in London some centuries ago, and this is why they had the great British Empire. It wasn't actually the British Empire, it was the empire of this group that had based itself in London, which is rather a different thing. And the Tavistock Institute is actually the center of the mind and mass consciousness manipulation web. They do tremendous research and have done for decades and decades, looking at what stimuli are needed to get a mass reaction of a certain kind. They also have worked with individual mind control. And getting to children very early has been a very, very big part of their operation and the whole manipulation, because if you can get them young, then you've got them for life. And interestingly, you know, these guys all over the world that keep going crazy with guns and killing children, like we had this guy, Thomas Hamilton, in Dunblane, who killed the children in the gymnasium, and we've had this guy, Martin Bryant, in Port Arthur, Australia. Well, the manifestations of these guys who go crazy with guns, and then, of course, you've got a problem. And what is the solution every time? Taking guns out of circulation. And what has happened is that we've got, after these events happen, we've got pulled into a debate of whether guns are good or guns are bad, which is a debate worth having. But the bigger debate at this time is this. Why, in every country virtually I go into, has someone gone crazy with a gun in the street or whatever, and then the solution has been gun laws, taking guns out of circulation? Why is that happening everywhere now? And when you relate that to some of the things we've been discussing tonight on this show about the agenda coming up across the millennium, it's much easier to impose things on an unarmed population than an armed one. And what I've come across only this week is this guy, Martin Bryant, who went crazy with a gun. He killed 35 people, something like that, in Port Arthur just a few years ago. He was treated, quote, for psychiatric disorders by a guy called Dr. Cunningham Dax, who was a Tavistock operative in Australia and for many decades was a close associate of a guy called John Rawlings Rees, who was the inspiration from the start to create the Tavistock network of mind control research and imposition. So when you look at Jonesboro in this country and many other events where people do spectacularly off-the-wall things, we need to understand that it is possible to program the subconscious to do that, and then all it needs to activate is the trigger, and that subconscious programming becomes the conscious action. And to understand that is to understand many of the apparently inexplicable things that go on, and why, again, assassin after assassin and crazy man with a gun after crazy man with a gun is dubbed with the same character profile, lone nutter, no conspiracy. And so the manipulation of children and the minds of the adult population is all part of this manipulation, because as I said to Art earlier, you cannot control billions of people physically. You have to do it through the mind and the emotions, and that's the way it's done.
So you believe that the philosophy that he put forth might have something to do with the chaos we're seeing now in children?
Yeah, I mean, I think we should let, my personal opinion is that we should let children have access to all information, and we should encourage them to make their own mind up. And I think once we start playing with methods and processes and systems with children's minds in whatever way they are, we are already creating a prison situation instead of encouraging them to be free in their thinking. And I think there's a lot of people, you know, who talk about freedom and the need for freedom, and then when you talk about the way they bring up their children, they say, well, of course I bring them up the way I believe. Well, that's not freedom, and I think we ought to put all information in front of everybody and then respect their right to come to what conclusions they want to come to instead of telling them what they should believe, which is what happens most of the time from cradle to grave.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Dave.
Thank you for the call. And Wildcard Line, you're on the air with David Icke. Hi.
Hello.
Hello, where are you?
Yes, hi, this is Jeff. I'm calling from near Tampa, Florida.
And on a digital cellular phone in a vehicle.
Yes, sir.
All right, see, I'm psychic. Go right ahead.
No, yeah, I knew you would like this phone. actually, my question is this. Gentlemen, you were mentioning an agenda, and I was wondering if, you know, with the coming of the millennium and whatnot, if you suppose maybe this agenda could be from perhaps, you know, a higher power, like, you know, could this be in the big plan, you know, maybe God's plan, or could ultimately this be have something to do with, you know, the coming of the Antichrist or, you know, anything of that nature? So I heard you talking, mentioning things about having a spiritual awakening and some experiences of that sort.
Yeah, but I also made the difference in my view of life. And like I say, we need to be at peace with the way each of us believe. I have a simple philosophy. Believe what you like as long as you don't impose on anyone else. And so I made the distinction in my view of life between religion and spirituality. They can be the same thing, and people can express their spirituality through religion, but there are other aspects of religion that can be anything but spiritual. I don't think the Inquisition in Europe was an incredibly spiritual experience, and indeed was one of the main fundamental means that I talked about earlier of sucking knowledge out of the public arena so it could be hoarded even more tightly in the secret society network, because, you know, 5 minutes of the Art Bell show would have been a suicide note at the time of the Inquisition, of course, because you weren't allowed to talk about these things. But in terms of the agenda and what have you and what's behind this, I go into this in enormous detail in The Biggest Secret, which is they're just about to go to press. It seems to me the way that I'm looking at these things now is that one of the key reasons why there is an obsession, there are a number of reasons, but one of the key reasons why there's an obsession with holding this genetic structure is somehow the vibrational resonance between that structure and the consciousness, which I think is operating from the lower fourth dimension, what other people call the lower astral, whatever name you call it. I call it the cesspit level. It's a level that vibrates to the lower vibrational emotions like fear and guilt and all this stuff.
You're speaking of the astral plane.
Yeah, I think that these particular key bloodlines resonate to a vibrational frequency that is far more compatible with this lower fourth dimension than the other genetic lines that are not of this particular type. And I think this world is actually being controlled from a consciousness that from the lower fourth dimension, myself. And it particularly works through these particular bloodlines. And if you like, for want of a word, it can possess these bloodlines far more easier than it can the general human population. And therefore, if you can manipulate these particular bloodlines into the positions of power in the world, what you're actually doing is manipulating into these positions of power a physical form which has a resonant compatibility with this lower fourth dimensional consciousness. In other words, you're putting the fourth dimensional consciousness into the positions of power. And I talked to so many people around the world who have come to this conclusion. It's staggering numbers, really, because it's not something that's widely talked about.
David, one quick interjection here. If there is at least a partial central control right now, and you certainly have alluded to that,
yeah.
Why in the hell aren't they doing a better job? The world is a mess right now, and if there is any kind of central control, they're certainly not exerting it with any effectiveness whatsoever. We have starvation, we have third world countries that are a disaster, that are beginning to industrialize, we've got Iraq, we've got little wars and troubles going on all over the place. Where is the control?
Exactly. You've actually described perfectly the control. And let me say some more about that. Try manipulating harmony. It's very difficult. Say I've got a room of people with me here. I haven't actually, but if I had a room of people with me here, and we were in harmony, we respected each other's right to have a difference of opinion, and we wanted to help each other when we were in trouble, and we were together, and we were really supporting each other. You try manipulating that situation. If I have a room of people here, and I don't like that person, and I'm having conflict with that person, and he doesn't like the lady over there, and they're having conflict. Suddenly, you're in a situation you can control, because you know you've got sides to play off against each other. So chaos is fundamental to control. Actually, the 33rd degree of Freemasonry, I understand, has a Latin motto, ordo ad chao, order out of chaos, which actually is problem, reaction, solution. And you talk about the famine and the starvation and stuff. Well, that's fundamental to the control for this reason. When you are in a situation where you have abundance and you have, therefore, choice, you are much more in control of your life. You're not dependent, that's the key word, you're not dependent on someone else to fill your belly. You're not dependent on some unpredictable, manipulated world, not commodity market, so that you have to depend on the price that sets for what you're selling to whether your country's going to eat or whether this is going to happen or this is going to happen or not. What has happened, for instance, in Africa? I mean, I've been to Africa quite recently, and the idea that Africa cannot feed itself is utterly, utterly ludicrous.
No, but I'll tell you what is going on in Africa. I was there a month ago.
Yeah.
What's going on in Africa is anarchy.
Exactly.
And I mean serious anarchy in the cities of Johannesburg, even Cape Town. You cannot go out at night and expect to live through the experience. I mean, the crime rate there is absolutely unbelievable. And since Nelson Mandela took over, I think he's afraid to move politically because he's afraid to be seen as that which was, you know, the iron hand that had control of everything supposedly at one time. And so he's doing nothing. And as a result, it's Russia times 10 right now over there. It's horrid.
Right. Well, I could talk about that because I too have been to Johannesburg and spoke and researched all around.
Well, then you know
that area of the world. Yeah,
you know.
But I'll just make this point before I come to that. The point being that what has happened in Africa is that transnational corporations with an interlocking leadership, when you go high enough up the pyramid, have gone in there and they have taken food growing land. They have put corrupt politicians in there to rule on their behalf, as they say, like the military junta in Nigeria, etc., which is controlled by Shell Oil.
Right.
And therefore, they have created a situation in which a continent that could feed itself is not feeding itself as a first priority. It's growing vast amounts of its food growing area. It's growing cash crops for the Western industry and the Western food industry and the Western chocolate industry, etc. And therefore, it's making Africa dependent over whether it eats or not on selling those commodities, getting money back, and then buying food in. It's created dependency, and dependency equals control. But the South Africa situation is very, very interesting and a fundamental point to make here. When I talk about the Great British Empire and all that stuff, people say, yeah, I can understand that. The empire, it controlled this country and it controlled that country. But it doesn't control them anymore, so it can't be true now. Well, what has happened, and this is so important a point to make, is that overt control, in-your-face dictatorship, always has a finite life because people know where they are. They're in a dictatorship.
Right.
And eventually the human desire for freedom will rebel against that. So the most profound and effective form of control is covert control, whereby you're running the show, but no one knows you're running the show because people don't rebel against not being free when they think they are. Now, let's take the South African example of this. It's a wonderful example.
Okay.
Before Mandela was led off Robben Island and became the president, the Oppenheimer family controlled 80% of the stock on the South African stock market. They owned the diamond and the gold mines on which the economy depends, and they controlled the media through various frontmen. Because that was we had white minority rule, that was an in-your-face, overt dictatorship. There was, of course, a great rebellion against it. The whole focus of world attention was, this is not free, this is apartheid, this is outrageous.
Mm.
So we then have the move to Nelson Mandela. Nelson Mandela is now president. Okay, who controls the country? Today, under black majority rule, The Oppenheimer family control 80% of the stock on the South African stock market. They own the diamond and gold mines on which the economy depends, and they control the media through various frontmen, not least an Irish guy called Tony O'Reilly. The difference is, however, Art, that no one's pointing to South Africa now and saying it's a dictatorship, it's not free human rights, because they're saying, oh, South Africa's sorted. We've got a black president, and off they go. But the same people run the show. And this is what's happened. As the great empires of Europe contracted on the surface, they left behind the bloodlines, and they left behind the secret society networks that have gone on running those countries covertly, and that can go on forever until someone points out that it's going on, because most people don't realize who runs their country.
All right, we can't go on forever. We've got to stop here. It's the bottom of the hour. David Icke is my guest. I'm Art Bell from the High Desert. This is Coast to Coast AM. All right, David, are you there?
I'm still there, Art, yeah.
All right, excellent. Here we go once again. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with David Icke. All right.
Hello. I wanted to mention a magazine called Covert Action Quarterly. It's put out by some former CIA and FBI agents who became so disgusted with the disinformation that was peddled constantly throughout the Cold War to justify non-existent and exaggerated foreign threats, especially on an anti-communist propaganda basis, to cover up with the fact that the real conspiracy is right here, designating as villains and demons anyone who disobeys the dictates of the transnational corporations and their police, secret police informers, such as the Central Intelligence Agency.
Okay, well, I will give you a caller this. The CIA was said to have dramatically, perhaps even intelligently, overestimated the Russian threat for all those years.
Well, what I wanted to get to, Art, is the fact that I think right now we have a situation where the death head's face is being exposed in this attempt to visit genocide once again on Iraq after starving about 1.5 million people to death, demonizing Saddam Hussein. And I think the control of the media is essential to this. Reliable sources shows how the media has acted in demonizing very characters different from each other, whether it's Castro or Saddam Hussein or the Serbs in Serbia. They have little in common except the fact that they have been uncooperative in obeying the dictates of the transnational corporations, the International Monetary Fund, and have refused to align themselves with such agencies such as NATO, which your guest has mentioned, or the United States. Unlike, for instance, in Yugoslavia, where the Croats and the Muslims have opportunistically signed on with NATO and the International Monetary Fund, the Serbs have refused this privatization type of policy that has spelled such disaster in the Soviet Union, pushing 75% of the people into starvation and poverty. Yet this is, I think, the real motivating force behind these kinds of interventions to, in effect, tell Saddam Hussein, we will starve, bleed, and break your country and your people, not because of these weapons of mass destruction, because we said that even if you obey all of these humiliating demands, we're still not going to stop starving and bleeding your people until you overthrow your government and put into a power submissive, subservient puppet.
Now, I don't necessarily disagree with that, David.
Well, there's a list of things there which all interconnect. First of all, let me go back to what I said not too long ago. If you're going to control a game, you have to control both sides, or you're not going to control the outcome. So what we need to do, I feel, is stop looking at people on different sides of a conflict. What I mean is not the people in general, but the people in control of the people on different sides, and stop seeing them as opposing forces and start seeing them as different faces of the same organization. For instance, Saddam Hussein, long, long ago, was a member of a very elite secret society called the Safari Club, which CIA people were also members of. And the Safari Club spawned something in France called the Pinay Circle, or Le Cercle, which has done fundamental manipulation and terrorist activity in Europe, and not least in France. And they are a network that was almost certainly involved in the coordination of the assassination of Diana, Princess of Wales, which I expose in enormous detail in this book, The Biggest Secret, and massively connected to the royal family and other people. So when you look at a situation of Bush back in the first Gulf War against Saddam Hussein, we need to start looking at two faces of the same side. And the pawns in the game are the American people, which Bush was over, and the Iraqi people, which Saddam Hussein was over. Why did Bush, who condemned Hussein as the new Hitler, and actually Bush should know because his father, Prescott Bush, was one of the funders of Hitler through the Harriman Organization, well documented in my books and others. Why suddenly did he stop before he got to Baghdad? People were taken aback. What's going on here? Why
was
he the job?
I was
why?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Why? Because they wanted to keep that situation so they could play the card again. I mean, the call is absolutely right. Again, we come to creating fear. Once you get people in fear, they'll give their power away to anyone they think will protect them against what they fear. So you bring in Colonel Gaddafi, a threat to the world. Whatever happened to him? And then you get another monster, and then he'll disappear, and they'll bring another one forward. First of all, it was Russia. The call is absolutely right about the Cold War. I talked to people in the intelligence community who were staggered to realize, because of course the intelligence community is fundamentally compartmentalized. Most people in the CIA are not trying to manipulate people. They think they're serving their country, like all these organizations. They were staggered to realize during the Cold War that American intelligence at a high level was passing over weapon technology and know-how to the Russians, so the Russians would keep parity or, in an ideal world, slightly ahead of the West. Why? Because if you want to justify massive arms spending with your companies which you control, and you want to up the ante of fear, frightening the West against the East and the East against the West, then if Russia's miles behind you, then the fear is dissipated. What? Russians can't even hit America. We're not frightened of them. So you ensure that there is parity or the Russians are just ahead. And then you go, oh, my good, the Russians are ahead of us. Oh, my good, all fear. We must have more arms spending. We must increase our nuclear arsenal. And then cynically the point came, and I actually predicted this in an earlier book, where the agenda's timescale, because there is a fundamental timescale, was to start to encompass the former Soviet Union countries into NATO and into the European Union, which is now happening.
Oh, yes.
That could never happen while, in Reagan's words, the Soviet Union was perceived as the evil empire. So out of nowhere comes Mikhail Gorbachev, the first Russian leader in Russian history. It didn't look like he'd just come back from a funeral. Suddenly, the wall comes down, Russia starts to have a smiling face, and bingo, the whole situation breaks up, allowing the encompassing into NATO and the European Union of these countries. Now, as I've shown in my previous book, Mikhail Gorbachev was a fundamental associate all the way through this, before he became president, of David Rockefeller and Henry Kissinger. What's Gorbachev doing now? He's running the Gorbachev Foundation, which puts on global events with top entertainers and top politicians calling for world government and world institutions to solve the problems of the world. It's all a movie. The CNN, I call it the movie channel. It's a movie we're watching, and we need to look behind the movie to see what's really going on.
West of the Rockies, you're on the air with David Icke.
Hi.
Where are you?
This is Les in Honolulu, KVH Radio 830.
That's KHVH, yes.
KHVH Radio, yeah. With regards to the fundamental time scale you're talking about, I got two questions. One, going back in that time scale, 300 years, and then my second will be to present day. Back in the early 70s, when I attended the University of Virginia, I was taken aside by a friend who's a assistant history professor who said, let me tell you a few things I'm not allowed to teach. He told me I learned a lot about Thomas Jefferson and how his focus was basically decentralized government, moving away from what they were doing in Europe, centralized government and industrialized city centers, and to come over here and form a nation that was based on a decentralized government and an agrarian society. And what we had was the Revolutionary War, and the British couldn't do anything about it then. They lost. They tried again in the War of 1812. That didn't quite work. So they decided to move their banking operations to the Northeast United States. And then we had the Civil War, and they told us it was about slavery, but actually it was an economic war. It was a banking war.
Mm-hmm.
And then we lost our revolution, so to speak. So I would like to get your comment on that and then ask my second question.
Well, again, in the Bigger Secret, as well as other books, I've gone into great detail into this period of the American Revolution, 1776 and beyond. 1776 was a key year, and I've been talking over the last few days on the phone briefly, but interestingly, with Richard Hoagland, who's come to the same conclusions. We've come to the same conclusions independently of how certain things happen at certain times, because we go back to the ancient world and we go back to this fundamental knowledge that's been sucked out of the public arena, but is held at the levels of the controlling elite that I'm talking about, and that is the knowledge of cycles, of sun cycles, etc., etc. Cycles which affect consciousness in certain ways, and energy flows which allow certain things to happen more effectively and more powerfully at certain times. So it's become very clear in my research that they don't have things happen in certain years, and they don't have to hold summits at certain places at certain times unless it's fundamentally in sync with the cycles they understand. Particularly sun cycles and the projections of energy from the sun. Of course, and across the year 2000, there's tremendous solar activity projected.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm sure that the Gregorian calendar syncing with that cycle is absolutely no coincidence whatsoever. But so 1776 was also the year that the Bavarian Illuminati was formed on May the 1st, which is one of their key ritual days of the year, run by a guy called Adam Weishaupt, who was then behind the French Revolution and many other revolutions in Europe. But I think it's so important that we suspend our dogma and we suspend our belief and we allow the information to lead us rather than our own preconceived ideas. And I've done a lot of research into the Founding Fathers, and I'm sure many of them had the best interests of people at heart, but some of them certainly didn't. And I'll name one, Benjamin Franklin. Benjamin Franklin was the Henry Kissinger of his day. He was working for British intelligence. He was very close to the British royal family. In fact, if you look at the history, this guy spent most of the time around the American Revolution, actually in London. He was a very close associate of a guy called Francis Dashwood, who ran a satanic ritual sacrifice operation called the Hellfire Club, which involved members of the royal family, which shouldn't surprise anyone because the present royal family is into all that stuff in Britain, as well as I'm about to expose in detail.
Really,
he was also a major Freemason in America, and he was a member of the key Freemasonry lodges in France. And he was playing all sides off against the center. And for me, when you look at this dispassionately, as I can as an Englishman in America, the American Revolution was to a very, very large extent an example of what I talked about earlier, replacing over control, which had a finite life, because those colonies were going to rebel eventually, if not then eventually, with covert control. And I think that there are so many, and this can be shown, so many strings that pull the economic and political system of America are actually pulled from Europe, particularly London. And just to finish the Benjamin Franklin story, to say that he was involved in ritual sacrifice and all that stuff is extreme, and I understand that. But this probably wasn't reported in Britain, but earlier this year, a story broke in London, in the London papers. They've given a grant of about £1.5 million to restore and renovate Benjamin Franklin's former house in Craven Street in London near Trafalgar Square, where he lived during the time I'm talking about. When they got under the floor as part of the renovation, they found 10 bodies, 6 of them children, in which some, there's been some unpleasant things done to them. They've got holes in the skulls and stuff like that.
and they've dated them to the time Benjamin Franklin was there, and the way that they've explained it or tried to is that Ben must have been into body snatching for medical research. Well, when you put that together with the Hellfire Club and that's infamous history and what it did in sacrificial chambers in a place called or near High Wycombe where Dashwood's estate was, then the whole thing starts to make sense, especially when these famous, world-famous people that are running the show today are into the very same ritual, and I can prove this.
All right, David,
people who have been there and seen it.
David, because of the length of the question, length of the answer, and time left, I'm going to just jump in and ask you.
Okay.
You said Princess, you just went running right by this. Princess Di was assassinated.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to ask you who because I don't want to be in trouble.
Yeah.
I'm going to ask you why.
Well, again, that would take around half an hour, but I'll summarize it briefly. I go into this in great detail in the book, and I've just got the opportunity to produce a two-hour documentary explaining what happened. I've been to Paris, and I've really researched this, and it's interesting that if we had half an hour to talk about this, all the kind of strands that we've talked about over the last 3 hours come together in this thing. The symbolism, these people are massively into symbolism, and you can read them through their symbols. For instance, one of the key symbols of this group in their secret language is the lighted torch. And the lighted torch is, of course, held by the Statue of Liberty, which was given to New York by French Freemasons. And a replica of the Statue of Liberty is on an island in the River Seine in Paris.
Right.
What did they do? It's a signature. When Kennedy was assassinated in Dealey Plaza, which was the scene of the first Freemasons' lodge in Dallas, and is a very big symbolic area in occult lore, the Freemasons, after the assassination, and it's still there, put an obelisk, which is an ancient symbol going back to very ancient times, Egypt and stuff, and on the top of that obelisk in Dealey Plaza, literally yards from where Kennedy died, they put a lighted torch or a depiction of one. What did they put on Kennedy's grave? They put the lighted torch, the eternal flame. What is the ritual place or the place of commemoration to Diana at the Pont down the tunnel in Paris? It's a lighted torch. In fact, it's a replica on top of that tunnel of the flame held by the Statue of Liberty. What did they put on the island in Althorpe Park where Diana's said to be buried? They put a lighted torch. This is the signature, and you can read it. That's the main one, but there are many others. And when you look at the symbolism, when you go back through these bloodlines to the Merovingians in France, they were the people that created the city we call Paris. They worshipped an ancient goddess called the goddess Diana, who was a moon goddess, symbolic of the moon. When they created Paris, initially, they built on the outskirts of the original Paris, but very much within the modern Paris, sacrificial chambers where they sacrificed to the goddess Diana. That sacrificial underground chamber the Merovingians built in the 8th century, 7th, 8th century, and earlier, in fact, is now another underground chamber. It's the Pont d'Alma tunnel where Diana died. Pont d'Alma means passage or bridge of the moon goddess, which is what Diana was supposed to represent. And the reason, and this is why we've had this tremendous questioning of why someone with injuries that if they'd have been got to hospital quickly, she would have survived, why was she kept in that tunnel for 95 minutes before they moved to the hospital? The reason was, and, you know, it's a throwaway line here because of time, but I document this in enormous detail in The Biggest Secret. The reason they kept her there is she had to die there according to their ritual. Because these people are so into ritual, it's staggering, and you can read them that way. And as I've explained in this Biggest Secret about the Kennedy assassination, you look at occult ritual, that was the symbolic assassination of a sun god, just as the assassination of Diana was the assassination of a moon goddess. And on the three-dimensional, non-symbolic way, I also completely connect it to the British royal family. It was fundamentally involved, and I named them, and it's time to stop running away, Art, and it's time to start running at this.
It's also time to stop the program. We're out of time. Okay. Very quickly, and the truth shall set you free. The phone number to call right now is 1-800, you finish it,
321-9054, 1-800-321-9054, and it will be in the post this morning if you ring now.
All right, very good. I want you to stay on the line for a moment so I can get a more permanent phone number from you so we can do a future show, all right?
Okay.
David, it has been a pleasure.
Pleasure, Rob. Thanks very much indeed.
Thank you, my friend. Stay right there, and I'll be back directly. Well, all right. That's it. If you would like a copy of this program, the entire 5 hours, and it's all been equally compelling, the number is 1-800-917-4278. That's 1-800-917-4278. And if you want your hair to stand on end, stay tuned for what comes next. I'm Art Bell.